Blog Talk Radio.
I'm a truth terrorist. I'm a knowledge gangster. I'm a black history hitman. I'm a lie killer, urban gorilla. I gotta be a roughneck.
Free the Black Panthers, FCBP. Stand for Free the Black Panthers. If up the black police, that 13th Amendment. Trying to make a slave of me. You can lock my body, can't trap my mind, not forever be free. Okay, Free the Black Panthers, FCBP. Stand for Free the Black Panthers. And fuck the black police. Feds infiltrated our movements for black leadership roles. But we still here, finna build here. Up coin tail pro. Show. They got me started, lying hearted. I'm the new Mufasa. And I'm all about Umoja, first in Gruz Usaba. Let's bring back the black families, we need our father. Single mama, son and daughter, that's root of the problem. Wise up, we wise up, unity so powerful. Black banks, black schools, black owned, black power moves. You telling lies, you think this shit gon' be televised. Black power, be scared guys, that be standing there like they paralyzed, ha. We say fuck all the system, cause we above the system. We keep ARs and pistols, shotguns that's worth the crystal. But that's for self-defense, make sure we have no issues. Be sure to leave it at the door if you have it with you. This for them freedom fighters, that lost their freedom. Until they freedom, we screaming carpe diem. This for the general, King Khalid Muhammad. We gon' make your day a holiday, I fuck me promise.
Free the Black Panthers, FCBP. Stand for Free the Black Panthers. And fuck the black police, that 13th Amendment. Tryna make a slave of me. You can lock my body, can't trap my mind, not forever be free. Okay, Free the Black Panthers, FCBP. Stand for Free the Black Panthers. And fuck the black police. Feds infiltrated our movements for black leadership roles. But we still here, finna build here. Up coin tail pro.
RBG, 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 RBG. My sisters, my brothers, the counselor, the elder, cause that's really all I need. We suited, we booted, don't do it, you stupid, we head to the armory. Black woman and goddess, regardless, my heart just don't fuck with misogyny. Boys that don't tolerate it, melanated, so you gotta hate it. Barack upped up another conversation, Trump finna get inaugurated, damn. Unify or die, NBPP.org.
First and foremost, the new Black Panther Party, no other Black Panther Party, we are not violent. We are for self-defense and self-determination. The most violent group in this country are the police. What is taking place by the police department to black people across this country is ethnic cleansing and genocide. It has escalated since the day that Barack Obama was inaugurated in 2008. We have a people who are only 13% of the population, yet we make up 80% of the prisons. We have 50% unemployment rate in the black community, and it's actually even more than that because they're not counting our people that are in the prison. The 13th Amendment says you cannot be made a slave or indentured servant unless you commit a crime. The 14th Amendment forced our people to be subjects of this government. We never had any say in that. We need our own nation.
I will explain this to you in the pandemic creation cycle. When I explain it, you have no control of power because this control of power stops at the moment, at the time being, at the domestic level. You have a certain control about your politicians, at least to a certain extent, but with directive generals of international organizations, you have no control. So if they establish a global health emergency council, which more or less dictates when the world enters into a pandemic, and especially dictating the countermeasures on medical and non-medical issues, I think it's highly concerning, especially if you know that they are intending to create a One Health approach. A One Health approach is they synergize or they streamline the climate, so the environment, the animals, and the human being, which is a huge range, a huge broad issue of governance. So that's the first issue. Then they're making the amendments to HR regulations, and the HR regulations, that is still not talked very much about it, because I most of the time never stop if I talk about the HR regulations, but they are actually having some legal obligations for member states. First of all, they establish permanent surveillance of any public health threat. And that's the most important thing. And the second important thing, they establish an emergency concept. And you have to have this in mind. As soon as the emergency concept is launched, the Public Health Emergency of International Concern, it's called FAKE, P-H-E-C, it's launched, the pharmaceutical industry steps in and can perfectly issue emergency use authorizations, or at least start the clinical trials for the emergency use authorizations. This concept only works with the Public Health Emergency of International Concern, which is legalized, which is framed or made legal in the international health regulations. So the other issue, which is very troublesome and which, of course, we have also seen in the IHR amendments by the U.S., is they will strengthen the global health emergency workforce, which is also already available at the WHO since they launched this WHO emergencies program, which I said since 2016, they started to be operative, going to the ground, which is very unique and very troublesome if you are a friend of sovereignty. So you have to bear in mind that national units can be transformed into global health emergency workforce units, which where there's already a list available at WHO. So the other issue is they will establish a network of health emergency coordination hubs. We already have one newly established in Berlin, which is especially for epidemiological intelligence. And intelligence connects again to the global health security issue, where you have security tied to public health, and in the end, the security dominates. So they will have intelligence hubs, and this means also more control of the information. So what they also have is a whole of society approach for the entire surveillance and for the entire community protection, and also whole of government approach. These are also very complicated things to explain, but at least they do not emphasize the rule of law approach. Whole of government approach and whole of society approach means that those ones who are just in control of the power can use the emergency powers, like the global health security doctrine. Very strongly reinforces. Then there will be a lot of funds. I can also not enter into this. A lot of a new financing structure, which is also requested because they're going to be operative. If you have an operative organization bringing all the medical countermeasures to your country, you need a lot of money, especially if it's protected by IP rights, intellectual property rights. So you have a whole set of actually reinforcing issues. So, and that's now where we actually are, giving you some brief information before. That's it, how is the WHO's pandemic creation cycle composed? So there are five issues. There's surveillance, the disease X list, the fake declaration, the procurement, and emergency use listing procedure, and then at least there's the health information control. So, and that's how the cycle looks like. So now you've heard of the international health regulations. Let's start with global surveillance. The global surveillance is part of a legal obligation of every country in the world. So every country in the world is obliged to legally obliged to surveil their public health status and to stop any health threat to the people on a 24/7 basis. And now they expand this approach to a One Health approach, which is also very problematic because the governance will go much wider for health. It will go to the environment and it will go to the whole veterinary animal sector, which is huge. So they are legally obliged to surveil, and then the question is, what do they surveil, and what is, you need diagnostics, you need treatment, and you need research for certain diseases, otherwise you have no capacity to surveil. So the WHO launched a very interesting new department. It's called the WHO Research and Development Blueprint. And this legal department actually defined a disease X list, which has become very famous and which I think needs to be famous to uncover it, because on this disease X list, they are cooperating with CEPI. And CEPI is the Coalition of Epidemic Preparedness Innovations, also has been formed by the World Economic Forum in Davos. And actually, CEPI gives their research grants to the WHO R&D blueprint list, where they can make all the diagnostic sets and everything the countries need to surveil. So at the next stage at WHO, you have the Director General with this unique authority, again from the International Health Regulations, from the IHR, where he can proclaim a fake. And in the IHR amendments issued by the US and in the end withdrawn, we see they expanded this concept, and it's also in the pipeline, and it's a very realistic concern that this concept is expanded to an intermediary alert. And this is actually not threatening to us, but it's threatening to us in the end, because the pharmaceutical industry very much awaits for this, because they complain, well, once you proclaim a fake, it's much too late to start the clinical trials. And we say we have to have a new vaccine from the virus identification to the vaccination in 100 days. That's the goal of CEPI. And it's not possible to do this if you do not actually start earlier and if you don't have an intermediary alert. And it's already such a alert in the WHO emergency use listing procedure, which is the next step, because they procure and authorize the new medical countermeasures and also the personal protective equipment and the in vitro diagnostics. So they have a huge authorization started on their own, you know, proclamation. So it's one regulation, it's one authority, the WHO, it's one office in charge of the global chain of pandemic creation, starting from the surveillance, identification of diseases, a proclamation of a public health emergency, and then authorizing the medical countermeasures. And they state in the proclaim, if you look at the disclaimer of the WHO emergency use listing procedure, you read, it's not an authorization. But if you go to Gavi website, or if you go to the Comirnaty global page, you can see that it is definitely an authorization. It's used as an authorization, 100% authorization, even if the disclaimer of WHO denies this. So you have this perfect mechanism, and this perfect mechanism gets much more perfect in the end if you control the health information. And the argument of controlling the health information is that there is an overabundance of information and that people need to be protected from this overflow of information. And misinformation is always, at the WHO level, is always very much associated, or 100% associated with political misinformation. And because they say it could be a political misinformation, we have to stop it and we have to censor it. And WHO has huge artificial intelligence networks established. It's in the piloting phase, but it's already huge. They do social listening. It's called social listening because the idea is that they want to hear the demands of the people, that the concerns of the people, but in the end, they need to identify who is spreading the misinformation. And in the end, the question of censorship arises, which we all know the contracts. They have a Twitter, they have Facebook for Good contracts, and they have a huge infodemic management team for the globe established. So I hope I gave you a short overview, even if it was a lot and I could not really go into detail with a lot of issues. But, you know, we have to go on. And the question is, you know, I think it's very good to target them legally, because there are certain issues like the WHO emergency use listing procedure, which is a non-listing, which is the authorization where we uncover certain things. And also the pandemic law creation initiative has to be countered with a lawful laws like protecting individuals from public health emergencies. That's our goal. So thank you very much.
I've got 100 questions and I wish we had time for them, but one thing I'd really like to understand, because a lot of people are very confused about what this all means for them actually, but if we look at the approaches that various governments around the world have taken following the so-called pandemic, China's still pursuing this COVID zero policy, which has had a massive impact on supply chains and so on, and other countries saying, well, we've got to learn to live with the virus. Those are obviously decisions that at this point in time have been taken at a national level. What implications does this all have for those types of decisions in the future?
Well, that's a very interesting question and a very far-reaching one. As far as we can analyze all the proposals and what has been written in the U.S. proposal at the latest stage withdrawn, we know that the sovereignty is threatened and the individual responses of states will be more or less the command and control structure from the global health actors or from WHO. This is what we know, but you can also, make the argument that, the exaggeration right now, the zero COVID politics, the WHO did not step up and say this is too much. This is enough because, sovereignty has been used in a bad sense. So there are two sides to the issue. And on the other hand, we see this problem with the transparency and with no accountability. There is an open WHO, there's a platform and the website that you can look up some information, but it's not that it gives you all the information, and we have absolutely no access how the decisions are made. And what is a real, real, real threat and concern is the external partners of WHO. And you know that more than 80% is sponsored by philanthropists who have their own agenda and who do not serve humanity and who are not public servants. And I think we are more or less sold as a marketplace and as an optimal investment case. And I think it's highly needed that we communicate the principles, what should be in the treaty. We have to say a stop to having the pharmaceutical industry making profits out of, pandemics. There should be a clear legal mandate for making profits on, higher risks, is it called in legal terms. And also protecting the individual, because global actors intervene much more into the domestic sphere and the individuals have no possibility or have no remedies against it. So, we have to be very active in the end, but we will cooperate internationally.
Okay, brilliant. Thank you very much, Dr. Sylvia Berendt. Thanks for joining us, and hopefully we'll see you again on one of these symposiums very soon.
Thank you so much. Thank you for the invitation and see you soon.
Next, let me welcome John Titus to the symposium. John Titus is an attorney. He has written, produced and directed videos about the loss of rule of law in the US since 2014. His videos focus largely on Wall Street crime and cronyism in the financial system. He has a Juris Doctor and has litigated patents for 25 years. He also holds bachelor's and master's degrees in electrical engineering and worked as an electrical engineer in the space industry. Since 2020, John has co-produced and co-hosted Money and Markets with Catherine Austin Fitz at Solari Inc. And contributed to previous symposiums of ours.
Good afternoon. My name is John Titus. I am pleased to be speaking again before Doctors for COVID Ethics. I am a federal litigator in the United States. I have been for the last 25 years. For the last 7 years, I have had a YouTube channel called Best Evidence. I now have a BitChute and an Odyssey channel by the same name. The channel talks about sovereignty, the rule of law, corruption, and the role that money plays in those topics. It might seem at first blush that those topics really aren't relevant to pandemics and the fear campaigns that we've seen, but in fact those topics are at the core of what has been going on for over the last 2 years. You might have seen recently the White House propose new international health regulations purporting to give the WHO, the World Health Organization, sweeping new powers. That proposal comes under actually the very same guises that we saw during the pandemic, namely health emergencies and experts, meaning, you know, we need to suspend law now, we need to suspend the democratic process now, and we need to leave all decision-making up to experts to decide in this instant what to do in order to avert a certain catastrophe. And, of course, the emergency just morphs into other emergencies. The expert control becomes a permanent feature of the landscape. That's all by design. But it is no accident that as we enter the third year of 2 weeks to flatten the curve, we now see the stage production of the smash film hit 12 Monkeys going to TV on the news channels. It is just another installment in an endless series of manufactured hobgoblins, starring, of course, the experts who, like Mighty Mouse, here they come to save the day, and they swoop in and they save us all, except they don't really save us all. What they do is they line their pockets and they pad their resumes, and while all the while they're victimizing the public. That playbook, actually, is, in fact, a rehash of what Wall Street did in the wake of the global financial crisis. Wall Street actually used a lesser emergency to pull off an even greater heist than we've seen in the last 2 years. So because Wall Street did it first and because Wall Street did it best, I think it's worth taking a look at that episode. And I want to explain how the Wall Street playbook is being used and being replicated now to the advantage of private parties, just like it was in the wake of the global financial crisis. Ultimately, it is a grab of sovereign power, only in the original Wall Street version of the power grab, it was an actual coup d'etat, while during the pandemic merely extends that coup into greater and progressively stronger degrees of control. So let me first explain the loss of U.S. sovereignty during the global financial crisis. You know, normally you might think of sovereignty of a country in connection with, you know, a war, or maybe a country losing sovereignty with an invasion. But the loss of sovereignty can also occur, and in fact more easily occur, as the result of a coup, which is exactly what happened in the United States at the time of the global financial crisis. Specifically, the sovereign power of the U.S. government passed from we the people, the public, you know, identified in the Constitution as being the sovereign, the people under the rule of law, that sovereign power passed to Wall Street banks, private parties, who were free to perpetrate whatever crimes they wanted to with utter impunity, and they used experts to cover their tracks and to cover their crimes and justify their crimes. And we know that that happened because when you look back, you can see Wall Street wresting sovereign power from the public. There is one very definitive tell on how that happened, and that is the availability or the ability of Wall Street to perpetrate any crime they want to with complete impunity. That ability, that immunity that Wall Street had during the global financial crisis and in the wake of the crisis is fundamentally inconsistent with the rule of law. Basically, it means Wall Street elevated itself above the law. It seized power in a coup and now has the unfettered power and has had the unfettered power to commit crimes ever since the global financial crisis. And I want to sort of explain that tell how we know what happened. It is widely known that Wall Street, that no major Wall Street bank and no major Wall Street executive was ever prosecuted or indicted, even when banks pleaded guilty to felonies, into criminal felonies. But that's not really the tell that there was a coup. And the reason for that is that the legal question of whether a sitting U.S. president can be prosecuted has never been directly addressed by the Supreme Court. There is some authority from prior departments of justice under Nixon and under Bush Jr. that suggests that a sitting president may not be able to be prosecuted while in office. And if so, it may be possible for a president to confer that immunity as, for example, as he does with a pardon. There's at least a colorable case to be made along the lines that I just laid out in connection with prosecution. So it may be that President Obama had the power to suspend the prosecution of Wall Street back in the wake of the crisis. By contrast, and regardless of whether the sitting president can be prosecuted, we know to a certainty that the sitting U.S. president can be investigated and can be subpoenaed both. We know that from the Watergate episode. Nixon was actually never indicted, but his co-conspirators were, Attorney General John Mitchell and John Ehrlichman and Haldeman and on down, those guys were indicted. And in that case, President Nixon was subpoenaed as part of that criminal case against his co-conspirators. Then Nixon tried to quash the subpoena and refused to hand over the tapes from the White House. And that case was taken to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court did address that issue, and the Supreme Court ordered Nixon to turn over those tapes. And 2 weeks after the Supreme Court ordered Nixon to do that, Richard Nixon became the 37th former president of the United States. So we have known since 1974 that the president can be investigated and can be subpoenaed, and that's an extremely useful litmus test in view of recent history, as we are about to see by flashing forward to the wake of the global financial crisis. It's 2009, 2010, 11, 12, and everyone is asking, hey, why isn't the DOJ prosecuting Wall Street even when banks commit these crimes and admit to committing these crimes? But no one was asking the predicate question, which is the DOJ investigating Wall Street? Well, as it turns out, almost no one was asking that question. There was one journalist who actually did ask, and it is this guy right here. This is Martin Smith. As you can see, he is with PBS Frontline, and he has shown here in the process of producing, in my opinion, the best piece of journalism for the last 50 years. It's a one-hour documentary called The Untouchables, and here he is shown interviewing this guy, Lanny Breuer, who up until this program aired on January 22, 2013, was the head of the criminal division in the U.S. Department of Justice. So he was number two in the DOJ behind the Attorney General, Eric Holder. That's a cabinet position right beneath the president. So Breuer is two rungs down. But Martin Smith exposes Lanny Breuer so completely as a liar and as a Wall Street shill that Breuer resigned in disgrace the very next day. The clip you are about to see answers the question of, well, since the U.S. president can be investigated and, in fact, was investigated and subpoenaed by the DOJ, surely Wall Street banks are investigated, too, in the wake of the crisis, right? Well, here's your answer.
We spoke to a couple of sources from within the criminal division, and they reported that when it came to Wall Street, there were no investigations going on. There were no subpoenas, no document reviews, no wiretaps.
Well, I don't know who you spoke with, because we have looked hard at the very types of matters that you're talking about.
These sources said that at the weekly indictment approval meetings, that there was no case ever mentioned that was even close to indicting Wall Street for financial crimes.
Well, Martin, if you look at what we and the U.S. attorney community did, I think you have to take a step back.
Okay, so you got that? No subpoenas, no wiretaps, no investigations at all. Smith also shows there was no whistleblowers, no witnesses. The Wall Street, the DOJ did not lift a finger to investigate Wall Street. Query who granted Wall Street those immunities, including immunity from subpoena, since it was not, as we just saw from the Watergate episode, the U.S. president. Who would even know the answer to that question? Well, for one thing, the DOJ would know, and luckily for us, they gave us the answer when a major Wall Street bank in late 2012 confessed, like Bernie Madoff, to a crime, and yet still the DOJ didn't prosecute, and it had to offer an explanation for why it wasn't going to prosecute the bank that admitted to this crime. So I want to show you this and lay some background here. Here you go. It is December 2012. The bank is UBS, as you can see here. Lanny Breuer is shown here again. He has just been annihilated by the press corps for announcing that the DOJ is not going to prosecute anyone at UBS, despite its confession to felony wire fraud in connection with rigging LIBOR, which is a very important interest rate affecting trillions of dollars of contracts. This guy here, this is behind Lanny Breuer, this is Eric Holder. He is the Attorney General. He is now going to come in and rescue Lanny Breuer from the press corps, and he is going to try to explain why the DOJ is not going to prosecute anyone at UBS. Neither of these guys tells the press corps. They leave out the fact that their law firm that they both came from, called Covington & Burling, represents all of Wall Street, including, yes, UBS. They leave that little part out, but Holder is nevertheless going to explain why it is that the DOJ is now not going to prosecute UBS despite its admission of perpetrating crimes. Listen to this explanation.
Impact. Let's be honest. Yeah. I mean, that's a factor. And I'm not talking about just this case, but in others that we have resolved. The impact on the stability of the financial markets around the world is something that we take into consideration. We reach out to experts outside of the Justice Department to talk about what are the consequences of actions that we might take.
Okay, so you got that? The Department of Justice has been consulting experts for 4 years after the global financial crisis. You know, as I said, it's a never-ending crisis. Crisis long since passed. They're still using that as an excuse not to investigate Wall Street. They are using experts, consulting experts, and these experts apparently can see into the future and divine what would happen if the DOJ were actually to follow the law and prosecute the criminals at these admittedly criminal Wall Street banks. The next question, obviously, is, well, who are these experts who can gaze into the future and explain what collateral consequences would flow from indicting Wall Street banks like UBS? Pray tell, who are these soothsayers? And I want to play you a clip, the only clip, in fact, you will ever see where anyone from the DOJ reveals who these collateral consequences experts actually are. I want you to listen carefully. The speaker here is going to be Lanny Breuer, and he is speaking at the New York City Bar Association. Listen carefully to who Breuer identifies as providing him with opinions in the DOJ. Here you go. There is Breuer. He is in front of the New York City Bar. It is September of 2012. Listen carefully to who he identifies.
We are frequently on the receiving end of presentations from defense counsel, CEOs, and economists who argue that the collateral consequences of an indictment would be devastating, just devastating for their client, and that even global markets will feel the effects.
Okay, you got that? Quote, defense counsel, CEOs, and economists, end quote, working for, quote, their clients, end quote, to give presentations to the DOJ on collateral consequences of indictments. In other words, it is the representatives of Wall Street banks telling the DOJ, don't indict us, don't indict our clients, and the DOJ, having been instructed not to indict, doesn't even launch an investigation of those clients of Wall Street at all. I mean, why investigate if you know you're not going to indict, right? And the answer is you're not going to investigate. The DOJ did not investigate. That is an undisputed matter of record. To be clear, the decision to ignore the law and not to indict or even investigate Wall Street banks came from Wall Street. And it came disguised as experts advising the U.S. executive branch on what to do in an emergency, the watered-down emergency back then being a fragile economy 4 years after the global financial crisis. But you see there, just in that example, the emergency never goes away, and the control never goes away by these experts. It has now been over 10 years since that time, and two or three different presidential administrations. The stock market has gone on to make multiples of what it was back then, and yet not a single major Wall Street bank, not a single major Wall Street executive has ever been perp-walked or indicted. That has never happened under any administration. Note carefully that the people who sold the public on the emergency are the ones who benefit from the emergency measures. In other words, it's Wall Street benefiting from, you know, the experts. Wall Street saying, don't indict us. Wall Street benefits from its own opinions. And it's people like Lanny Breuer and Eric Holder and their law firm, Covington & Burling, acting to the benefit of their clients, their private clients, at the expense of the criminally victimized public. That exact same dynamic of experts working harms on the public to benefit private parties has gone on from day one of the so-called pandemic, and really, if you've been paying attention, it's been going on before day one. The WHO is only the most recent example of this dynamic. The WHO relies on experts so as to benefit the public, the public. But even the most rudimentary research reveals that the WHO's opinions actually benefit WHO investors and harm the public. And I'll just use Pfizer's COVID-19 as a convenient example. It's a trivially easy example. And you don't even have to venture that far beyond the WHO's own website to see the graft and the corruption staring you straight in the face. So let's just go over to the WHO website, and I will show you what I'm talking about. Here is the WHO website, and you can see there at the bottom, the Pfizer-BioNTech COVID-19 vaccine, what you need to know. What do you need to know? Well, according to the WHO, quote, the Pfizer-BioNTech COVID-19 mRNA vaccine is safe and effective. Now let's look at what the WHO will not tell you. Here I am looking now at the VAERS database. It is maintained by the Centers for Disease Control, the CDC. VAERS stands for Vaccine Adverse Event Reporting System. It is a searchable database of events that can and do occur after patients take a wide variety, a host of different vaccines. Let's take a look here. I mean, you can see there up at the top, I'll just circle it. The data is current as of May 27th, 2022. You can search different fields. So we want to go over to the left here and look at vaccine information. The vaccine we're interested in is COVID-19. The manufacturer, as I said, is Pfizer and BioNTech. There we go here. And the event we want to look at in connection with this safe and effective vaccine is, did the patient who took these vaccines die? Yes, they died. Let's now conduct a search and see how safe and effective this vaccine really is, the Pfizer's vaccine specifically. Whoops, here we have it. It's 18,500 cases where the vaccine is COVID-19. The manufacturer is Pfizer-BioNTech, and the patient died. Okay, so the WHO does not disclose to you the 18,500 cadavers generated by the Pfizer vaccine. Oh, no, they're not going to tell you that. Instead, the WHO conceals all facts that do not promote the advantages of vaccines. The next question is, who is benefiting from the WHO's role as basically an advertising agency for the vaccine manufacturers? They're concealing information. Why are they concealing information? I am now going to show you the shortest money trail that you will ever see in your entire life. Let's just go straight to the WHO. We're going to go back to the WHO's website, and I am going to show you its list of donors. And you can see here, right at the top of the list, we have the second biggest donor is the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. They've contributed $750 million to the WHO just in 2020 and 2021. So the question is, I wonder how they might stand to gain by giving the WHO money. That is the central question here. Let's just take a look, for example. Let's just start with, what stocks are they invested in? That seems like a sensible question. Here we go. Here's an article from a well-known site. It is called The Motley Fools, well-known in America, has been for at least 20 years. And you can see here, if we look, this article from The Motley Fool is dated September 24th, 2020, so 3 months before the vaccines come out, and the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation is betting on certain stocks. And to be clear, this isn't just, the article points this out very clearly, this isn't about the foundation, where is it, here you go, it's not just handing money over to the drug makers, we are talking about direct investments they are making to make money on vaccines. And so let's scroll down and see what they are investing in. And here we go. It is Mr. Safe and Effective himself, Pfizer and BioNTech. And now you see how the game of in-your-face corruption works. There it is. It's up close and personal. That's how things go on. That's how business is done with the WHO. To summarize, Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation invests in Pfizer and God knows what else, what other companies, what other investments they have in the vaccine space. They then pour $750 million into the WHO, which turns around and touts Pfizer's vaccine that they just invested in while concealing the biggest pile of cadavers ever produced by any vaccine ever. If you doubt me, just go search on flu vaccines and tell me how many you find for all 15 variants of the flu dating back 30 years. I think the number is about less than 2,200. The compression with the COVID-19 vaccine, which has only been out like 18 months, is produced, and just one manufacturer has produced 18,500 dead bodies that the WHO is not telling you about and that the executive branch is not telling you about. The executive branch of the United States government gets fully behind this in-your-face corruption, this in-your-face out-in-the-open graft, and it has been a major force behind that graft for well over a decade now, starting with the global financial crisis. The U.S. executive branch, to be clear, works for private corporation and banks. Banks are at the top of that. It has done so since the global financial crisis. Its M.O. is to replace the democratic process and the rule of law with the rule of private corporation. Again, like I say, banks are at the top. And it does so, as we've seen, by using emergency and crises to trot out so-called experts who gain financially and professionally by advancing companies' interests in the name of the public good and directly to the public's benefit. The WHO is just an example. It's an example of a privately funded cohort of experts that short-circuits the democratic process. Let me tell you something. Wall Street got away with the crimes because it possesses the sovereign power of money creation. I am going to talk about this in a new series. I'm using this presentation as a sort of an introduction to that series called Murder of a Rebel Nation. It is going to be a 10-part series that walks through all of this in excruciating and lurid detail. But Wall Street got away with this because it has a sovereign power of money creation, and it held a gun to the government's head before the bailouts of 2008 and said, you give us $700 billion, we'll kill you. And they meant it. Big Pharma, though, does not have that kind of leverage that we saw with Wall Street. It doesn't have the sovereign power like that. So my advice is get out of the WHO while you can, and if you hear the phrase, leave it to me, I'm an expert, run for your life, because you are being sold a lethal bill of goods. With that, I thank you for your time and attention today, and enjoy the rest of the presentations here at Doctors for COVID Ethics. Thank you.
And finally for this session, Taylor Hudak speaks to Professor Christian Perron. Professor Christian Perron is an infectologist, former VP of the World Health Organization European Advisory Group on Immunization, as chairman of the Communicable Diseases Commission at the French High Council for Public Health. He helped several governments for the management of epidemics.
I am professor of infectious disease in a university hospital in Paris, but during 15 years I was working part-time for the Ministry of Health. I was chairman of several commissions for public health management, management of health crisis, epidemics, and so on. And I was also chairman of the official vaccine committee in France during several years. And I was vice chairman of the European group of experts at the World Health Organization, the group called ETAGE, during several years also. And I was president of the College of the French Professors of Infectious and Tropical Diseases. So I could manage in the past health crisis epidemics with different governments, and I have an expertise in this field.
So I just want to get right into the hot topic of the day, and that, of course, is this monkeypox virus and these outbreaks that are being seen in several countries throughout the world. Now, typically, we have seen outside of Africa, there have been isolated events in single countries when it comes to outbreaks of the monkeypox virus. But with the current outbreaks, it seems that this pattern seems to follow more of a simultaneous spread to multiple foreign countries, and that's quite unusual. So does this recent outbreak within multiple countries and on multiple continents have any precedent?
No, and it's impossible that the occurrence of such isolated cases in 10 different countries on different continents. It's impossible naturally, because monkeypox, the pox of the monkeys, sometimes it can contaminate humans. Usually the infection in humans is mild, but sometimes in some outbreaks in Africa, there were mortality rate between 1% and 3%. Sometimes they say 10%, but it seems to be lower than that. But, and the, to transmit from a monkey to a man is possible, but it's not frequent. And from one man to another man, it needs a very close contact, like a prolonged period. It's not easily transmitted. So I don't understand how it's possible, because we, for decades, sometimes there are small outbreaks in Africa among humans, but it's a local outbreak. It never spreads outside the continents. And so the same day, there were occurrence of isolated cases among people who never traveled, and in the French communique of the Ministry of Health, they said, I don't know if it's still the case now, but at the beginning they said this infection involves mainly men having sex with men, but I don't understand how sexually transmitted route is possible if people are at thousands of kilometers aside from one of each other. So, and they said in the same communique that it was transmitted mainly by the respiratory route. So it's in the same text that it's sexually transmitted in a man having sex with men, but it's also respiratory transmitted. So for me, it is not possible. I think there are real cases, but I was very surprised when I saw that. Because you know that Bill Gates has given money to develop the vaccine against different types of poxes, including the monkeypox. And he declared recently that the world will have to face a pandemic with a new virus derived from smallpox. And also recently, the European Medical Agency had made a statement. It was at the end of the last year, 2021. They were preparing to give authorization for a new drug that has not been really tested. And they are starting now in Africa test with the Pasteur Institute in Bangui in Central Africa to evaluate this new drug. So for me, it's something that I don't understand, because they announced the epidemic before. They already started to develop a vaccine, a new drug, and then you have like that isolated cases in different countries. And what is very surprising, all these new cases appeared in countries, in rich countries. There were no new case in Africa or in the countries where there are a lot of monkeys. So I don't understand. I think it's not natural.
Now, I will ask you to speculate here, but what could possibly be the cause of these outbreaks?
I think that the virus exists. I don't know if it has been modified in a lab. I have no idea about that. But if we come back to the natural history of natural pattern of the clinical presentation of monkeypox in humans, it's like smallpox. But, you know, smallpox now has been eradicated from the planet thanks to the vaccine. At that time, before the vaccine, smallpox killed one-third of the patients who were contaminated. For the monkeypox in humans, I told you it's 1 to 3%, so it's much lower. Of course, 3% is 100 times more than the mortality of COVID, but it's not a so aggressive disease compared to the classical human smallpox, which disappeared thanks to the vaccine. Now, if you are contaminated, you have rapidly high-grade fever, great fatigue, and very rapidly you have cutaneous vesicles everywhere, including on the face. So it's not an asymptomatic disease, you know. Cases can be rapidly identified also in the street, because you can, but these cases don't walk in the street because they are too ill. They have to stay in the bed. So I don't believe in a huge transmission, because people with this disease won't go in the subway or won't go to work, because they will be very ill, even if they will recover after a few days. And the transmission from man to man is difficult, needs a very prolonged contact, very close. So, of course, there will be outbreaks, but I think it's not a good candidate to make a huge pandemic. I think it's more to make people threaten to probably to accept a new vaccine. I don't know.
Now, you mentioned smallpox. So let's compare monkeypox with smallpox. How are these viruses similar in terms of virulence or disease severity and contagiousness?
Because it's the pox family of viruses, so you have the cowpox for the cow, from which was created the vaccine made by Jenner, you know, to eradicate the smallpox, because the vaccine virus was gave a mild disease in humans, so protected from the human pox was a smallpox, it was called like that. So smallpox was a very dangerous disease with a high rate mortality, but it disappeared at the end of the, it was in at the end of the 70s or the beginning of the 80s. There is no more case all around the world. And you have only two labs in the world who kept the virus, one in the United States, one in Russia. And normally, officially, all the other labs a long time ago have destroyed their stockpiles of the virus. And so different species of man and animals have their own pox virus. And so I told you about the cows, also the monkeys, they have their own virus. It's a cousin of the human virus. But it has been observed for decades that this virus, which gives a mild disease in humans, sometimes you have some lethal cases, but they are rather rare. They are dangerous for monkeys, but not so dangerous for humans. But they are closer. Probably there is a cross reaction between all of these viruses for immunity. And experts in the domain said a long time ago that probably the smallpox vaccine could protect against the monkeypox.
To help us better understand this virus, how in the past did monkeypox arise? And was this primarily by contact with animals or human-to-human transmission?
The monkeypox was a virus for monkeys and transmitted among monkeys' communities. But sometimes, by chance, a man could be contaminated by a close contact with a monkey. Sometimes in Africa, people kill monkeys to eat them, and they get then contact with the body. So there were cases reported for decades of monkeypox, mainly in Africa and Central Africa. That's known of the medical community. But it was not considered as a threat for humans since it was localized. It occurred in people in close contact with monkeys. Sometimes they contaminated a few people around them who lived in very close contact in prolonged during a prolonged time with them, in the family and so on. But we never observed a large outbreak coming out of the borders of a country or even in the region in a country. So what occurred a few days ago is completely new. And for me, it's not natural. It's impossible to have one case in the United States, one in Canada, one in Spain, one in Sweden, one in France, and in 10 other countries the same day.
So is it possible that genetic tampering may have caused this outbreak?
I'm not sure. Maybe it's a natural virus that just spread like that. But as you know, some people gave funds for what they call the gain of function of animal viruses to make them more virulent, more communicable between humans. So it's something possible, but I have no data about that. I cannot pronounce myself about that today. But in my head, I say it's bizarre.
Very interesting. Now, how were previous and earlier incidents of monkeypox dealt with?
There were some outbreaks in Africa. It was in the Congo, Central Africa. But they were recurrent in some regions, but they were always localized. So it was not a threat for the at the global level.
How would you typically treat someone if they were to test positive for this virus?
At the present time, there is no, not a single antiviral drug that has been studied correctly, because some said this drug could be effective on a small group of patients, but there were no real big study to confirm that. So the medical community agrees that there is no really recommended treatments, even there are some speculations about that. And what is strange is that the European Medical Agency just made a pre-advice in at the end of 2021 to say, yes, there is a new interesting drug to treat monkeypox. At that time, there was not a single case in the world, but the coincidence is bizarre.
What was the case fatality rate in previous monkeypox outbreaks? As far as I understand, in Western countries, it was zero among just a limited number of cases.
Yes, there were not a single case in the Western world countries. All the cases reported were in Africa, in a few numbers of countries. I think that there was Congo, Nigeria, Central Africa, that there could be some cases, but always a few number of patients were contaminated, and with the isolation of the patients, the transmission of the virus stopped.
Is it possible that this outbreak of monkeypox in various countries is in any way related to COVID-19 vaccinations?
What I've heard, but I don't have the confirmation about that, it's monkeypox is usually very mild, but some, I read that just before this interview, so I didn't verify the data, but I've read an expert saying that a kind of immunodeficiency induced by the COVID-19 vaccine could enhance the virulence of the monkeypox. For me, at the present time, it's a speculation. I have no proof about that, but it should be confirmed or not.
Now, earlier you did mention the desktop planning exercise in March of 2021, which was about monkeypox. So is there any scientific reason that there could have been that they chose this particular virus as their new case? I mean, we saw back in October of 2019, there were simulations and pandemic preparations made for a virus eerily similar to COVID-19, just months before COVID-19 was being discussed in the media. So do you find this a little bit odd, and what should the public be making of this?
You made the point. It's very surprising to see that in 2019 there was an international meeting with Bill Gates and many important people in different countries saying, "Oh, you should be afraid of a pandemic of coronavirus will occur very soon." And just a few weeks later, there was the start of the pandemic of coronavirus, the COVID-19 virus in China. And they had already prepared the vaccination. And now I think to see the same scenario, they tried to work on a new vaccine since 1919. Now they say there is a new drug possibly effective. We don't know exactly because I didn't see the studies. I think they are not very good. They made a planification meeting at the international level. And now suddenly cases occur all around the world the same day. So I'm not a conspirationist, but it cannot be natural.
Exactly, and I think this really speaks to the corruption within the public health industry, and that's what I also want to talk about next. And I had the great pleasure and honor of meeting you personally in Malmo, Sweden at the Northern Light Convention, and you had a really great presentation that you gave, and you expressed the opinion, with facts, of course, to substantiate this, that COVID-19 was really a pandemic of fear and a pandemic of corruption. So can you speak more on what you meant by that?
because we know that many leaders, key opinion leaders in the world, have a financial interest in the pharmaceutical industry. I don't criticize that if they keep honest, if they do their job, if they collaborate with pharmaceutical companies to improve development of new drugs, of new tests, that's nice. But the problem is that all these links are hidden, even if they declare some amount on the official website where you have to declare your what you receive from this industry. We know I have friends in the pharmaceutical industry at the highest level. For decades, I know that some key opinion leaders receive money on offshore accounts. That's well known in this field. So we know that they are under influence.
As you said, you worked with the WHO for several years. So what would you say is the attitude among your colleagues at the WHO? I mean, do they really care about public health? Or is there another motive?
I stopped working for WHO several years ago. When I was working there, I was in a very good relationship with all the colleagues coming from different countries. They were all very nice scientists and experts and honest people. I think the problem is not coming from them, but I think that an upper-level manipulation or all this. But I know that people inside WHO today are upset about what is happening, because now if you're following the news, they want to put WHO upon all the governments to manage the health crisis in the world and to implement laws in the different countries who are already signing a treaty. So that's a terrible thing, because each country must keep its independence. I'm in favor of international collaboration, but not of it's like a dictatorship.
It's like a dictatorship.
Yes.
Is there anything else that you would like to add to this discussion or any other points that you want to leave us off with today?
To finish, I would like to say that I'm rather optimistic, because despite all the horrible things we had to support to accept for 2 years, there are so many evidence coming out in many countries, so many now attacks in justice about very serious problems with all the proofs, that it will not be possible to continue all this disinformation for long.
Okay, well, thank you, and I appreciate your taking the time to speak with me today, and also for being so brave and really speaking out to ensure that the public has access to the truth. So once again, Professor Christian Perrone, thank you.
Thank you very much, Taylor.
Well, thank you to Professor Perrone, John Titus, and Dr. Sylvia Berendt, and of course, Taylor Hudak. We'll take a 5-minute break now, and we'll be back for session 4 with Catherine Austin Fitz. See you then.
Okay, ladies and gentlemen, session 4. It's more than medical tactics, and what's the action? Because as you can tell, we're dealing, if tyranny is the problem and freedom is the solution, how do we free ourselves from not just medical tyranny, but all forms of tyranny, and get back to creating a human civilization that supports the rule of law? So we want to do a little bit now to unpack the excuses for central control. We have 3 different presentations in this section. The first one, I'll be joined by Dr. Richard Werner, Professor Richard Werner, who for me is the preeminent scholar globally in central banking and banking. And we're going to talk about We're going to talk about the many excuses for central control. We're then going to have a section on solutions with Merrill Nass. And then our final panel will be Faith in the Failure of Totalitarianism with Mary Holland, Dr. Nass, and Peter Bregan. So now, Richard, first of all, I just have to say, I know you're in Asia. Thank you coming in from all the way of Asia. We kept you up very late, but we so wanted you on here because I don't think there's anyone who understands the centralization from the very top of the financial system as you do. And I want to start off with one of your great works is both your book and documentary, The Princes of the Yen, where you deeply studied the Japanese central bank and its relationship to the banking, central banking institutions globally. Tell us a little bit about how that happened and what it taught you about the issues of centralization that we face.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me, by the way. Well, it was essentially, all the knowledge that's in the book was gathered when I was still a student working on my doctoral dissertation, doing doctoral research, and I was initially on a stay in Japan as the first Chimomura fellow at the Japan Development Bank, now called the Development Bank of Japan, and in Otemachi in Tokyo, and then later at the Bank of Japan itself. And it was a bit of an undercover sort of detective story, because by that time, I mean, since 1991, it was quite clear to me what the mechanism was and what I need to look for to dig deeper and find out what's happening. Before there were all these puzzles, you know, this asset price surge and Japanese capital outflows, and nobody could explain it. All the economic models didn't work. And then in 91, I discovered how it all works, and the answer was the banking system. You know, these huge capital outflows in the 80s, buying up, you know, Rockefeller Center, Pebbles Beach Golf Course, Hawaii, you know, you name it, Japanese money everywhere, the Japanese century, the 21st century is going to be the Japanese century, everyone was saying. But it was so much money, nobody could explain why, you know, where did it come from and why was it invested? Because actually on the exchange rate, Japanese investors were losing money. It was against all the models. But the answer was that it was essentially money creation, excess money creation by the banking system in asset markets, which partly spilled over as investors wanted to diversify a bit. And when I uncovered that, I realized that, wow, these banks are being left out in economic theories entirely. They're just not in economic models. There's no banks in there, but really they're very crucial to understand the economy, because banks are not financial intermediaries, as the textbooks tell you. The textbooks will mention them and then drop them after they've explained that they're just financial intermediaries, therefore they're not really interesting. They're just sort of reallocate a little bit. They have, you know, they gather deposits and then they look for investment opportunities, do their credit analysis, and that's it. So like anyone else in the financial markets, you know, so we just have the bond market here to represent all these financial markets, including banks, but we don't need to consider banks. The reality is banks are totally different from anyone else out there. Mm-hmm. Why? Well, they have a banking license, and that is essentially a license print money, maybe more literally than you'd expect, because and actually there have been three theories of banking throughout the last century. The one that's in the textbooks now is the financial intermediation theory. Banks are just financial intermediaries. But there was an earlier one from the 1930s to 1960s, and some people still remember or have older textbooks where they saw it as students, namely the fractional reserve theory of banking. That one says that each individual bank is a financial intermediary, gathers deposits, lends out the money, but somehow as the banks interact, something happens and money is created. Mm-hmm. That was already too much information, you see. I think they decided, because that got people thinking, well, hang on, there's this money multiplier. Wow, that sounds kind of interesting, isn't it? Money multiplier. You start to think about, okay, where does money come from and how is money created? That was too much. Therefore, they moved to the financial intermediation theory, where there's no money creation at all. But the third theory is the oldest. And that one says, no, banks are not financial intermediaries, not individually, not in aggregate. They are creators of the money supply. Mm-hmm. Whenever a bank gives out a loan, new money is created from nothing, essentially, and it's added newly to the money supply. The money you see in your account, that is added to the money supply when you take out a bank loan. So these three theories differ, on this point, you know, on the question of where does the money for a bank loan that's given out to the borrower actually come from? Is it other people's deposits? That's the financial intermediation theory. Is it excess reserve? That's the fractional reserve theory. Or is it from nowhere? Is it created newly? And, well, I did the empirical test, and the answer is it's actually, of course, the credit creation theory. And then once you understand that, of course, it's clear that banks are crucial because they are very different from anyone else. They create the money supply, and their decisions about how much money is created, who is it given to, and for what purpose? And banks always check what is the use, and they even control that it's used for that agreed purpose and nothing else. These decisions completely reshape the economic landscape in a very short time period. So that's why it's so important to have the right banks make these decisions.
Right.
And yeah, sorry. Go.
I should just mention that I don't know if you had an opportunity to see it, but in one of the last presentations, John Titus went through the bailouts and explained why the Department of Justice in the United States had established a precedent that they were also above the law. So this ability to create money and also to be immune from the law in combination is an extraordinary power.
Yes. Well, in the UK, I've encountered this in parallel. Maybe the precise legal sort of reasoning is different, but de facto, they're also above the law because there's certain topics that the courts will not even tackle, even when people, you know, bring them up in their disputes with banks. So they seem, you know, that they're sort of, they have this aura like where you know, the judges won't go.
Right.
And it's just established practice, and therefore it must be right because it's been done for 200 or 300 years, you know. So now, so, but once you understand that, you realize this is the answer. And I realized this in Japan. And then at the same time, I saw the data on these banks, and I realized, wow, they've created these huge amounts of money to purchase assets. But that's a very specific use of money to purchase assets, you know, to purchase ownership rights, which means it doesn't actually go into GDP. This newly created money is going into asset markets, creating therefore an artificial asset bubble. And banks always, because it's a network system, they always copy each other. They more or less have to act similarly to each other. Otherwise, it does actually create problems in the banking system. It's a network structure. And so, you know, when you get property lending going up, they all do it. You get a property bubble and so on. And we've seen it with various types of assets. Doesn't that matter which asset ownership rights? Can be derivatives, can be complex financial instruments. It doesn't matter. It's the same mechanics. And this happened, of course, in Japan in the 80s. But it's a Ponzi scheme, a snowball system.
Right.
It works while and as long as banks continue to create more credit, creating more loans and more money, therefore, for purchasing assets. Once that stops, that means the music stops in a game of musical chairs, and there aren't enough chairs for everyone to sit. So then asset prices stop going up, and then the late coming speculators will be the first ones to go bust because they don't get any more capital gains that they've been betting on. And then you get non-performing loans, then banks get more risk averse, then they reduce lending actively, and then, you know, asset prices go down further, you get more bankrupt, and then more non-performing loans. And of course, you can quickly get a banking crisis because from the peak that you've pushed asset prices up by, say, 100%, 200%, 300%. They only need to go down by 10%,
right,
because they're the collateral for the banking system asset side. And then you've got 10% non-performing loans, or 15% is usually enough to bust the entire banking system because equity is only usually 10% or even less, as we saw in the May crisis. And if you've got non-performing loans, to make up for the hole in your asset side of the balance, it has to come from equity. So then you have a bust banking system. That's why we have these boom-bust cycles and banking crises. And so I realized early on, wow, this is going to blow up. So in 91, when I came back from Japan to Oxford, you know, working on my you know, first master's exams and then my doctoral dissertation, put out my first paper, which explained the capital flow story, the bank credit creation is behind it. And as a corollary, actually, this was an asset bubble created by the banks. It now has to be expected that, and at that time, remember, 91, Japanese banks were the biggest in the world. The top 10 banks were all Japanese. And also, because the stock market had come down in 91 by quite a bit, almost 50%, but GDP was growing by 7%. Everyone was saying, well, Japanese stocks are cheap. Now the Bank of Japan is going to lower interest rates. According to the official story, we'll talk about it later, interest rates are the key variable. So they're lowering them, so everything is going to be fine. Stock market is going to go up. Buy Japanese stocks. My conclusion was the opposite. Japanese banks like to go bankrupt. Japan is going to move into the biggest recession since the Great Depression. And because, I mean, people didn't believe me for years. They thought, well, he doesn't really know Japan. Japan's going to take over the world now. But that enabled me, this gap, this time gap, enabled me to keep digging deeper while nobody else was really aware what was about to happen. And I then got a researcher place, visiting researcher at the Bank of Japan with, you know, the name card from the Bank of Japan. I went around to meet all the bankers in Japan, and I wanted to interview people who were in the key positions in the late 80s personally to interview them. So I gathered lots of eyewitness testimonials, which then were written up in Princes of the Yen. And I've got lots of direct quotes from bankers. I could even interview the central bankers on the record, tape recorded, about their role in the late 80s in managing all this. And because the key question was, okay, why on earth did banks lend and therefore create so much money for asset purchases that there could only be a huge banking crisis after?
Right, it could only end in heartbreak. Why would they do that?
Exactly.
Right.
So why did they do it? And I started, actually, it's quite interesting, sort of in sequence. I started with the loan officers. I wanted to hear what's the frontline story of a loan officer in a branch of a bank dealing with customers. And I was introduced in Japan. They're really great, and people like to talk to foreigners. You know, so it was really easy to get introduced to the right people. They're very happy to talk about their personal experience. And it's great. It was great material for me to learn what was happening. And they were telling me, oh, it's crazy stuff. You know, we really pushed out the loans. We cold called corporate company owners, for example, new corporate clients that hadn't even got a bank account with us, had no business with us. We called them up and said, look, we found some property, some real estate. We did the calculations. We lend you the money. Now you just need to sign. All the paperwork is done. We think it's going to go up by 30-40%. You're going to make this much money based on our loan. You know, sign here.
Right.
That's how they expanded. So super aggressive, pushing out of, you know, loans. And then they would say comments like, oh, you know, it's crazy times. I think we were creating an asset bubble. Because at the time, people weren't even saying that, oh, it was a bubble. Because
right.
It wasn't, you know, everyone thought things are going to recover, just a temporary slowdown and so on. But the loan officers were aware, wow, this, you know, we are really pushing up prices with this. So then I asked them, so if you were concerned about this, why did you do it? And they would say, well, I was just doing as I was told. I was given orders by the branch manager.
So I was sitting.
And then
go ahead.
Branch managers would say the same thing. Sorry, just to complete that sequence. and I'll keep it short. The branch manager would say the same thing.
Right.
You know, we're pushing out loans. I was concerned this is creating the bubble. Why did you do it? I asked them. Well, because I was given orders, instructions from headquarters. there was a quota I was given. Then I went to the headquarters people, the strategic planning department of all the big banks, and asked them, so, you know, tell us what happened in the 80s. Yeah, we gave out these huge loans. We gave huge instructions to big quotas every 3 months to increase lending, you know, to all these property speculators. We thought we're creating a bubble. It's really concerning. Why did you do it? Well, we're given orders. By who? By the boss of the bank? Oh, no. By the central bank.
Right.
The central bank told us through window guidance. This is guidance of bank credit. They give us a quota. It's an obento lunchbox that was to be eaten, not to be exceeded, not to be undershot. You had to lend exactly that amount every 3 months. And they gave us huge quotas. They forced us essentially to create this property bubble. Then I went to the central bank staff, and they told me the same story. Oh, late 80s, crazy stuff. We were telling the banks to increase lending by all this, you know, property lending. We're creating a bubble. We're really concerned about it. So why did you do it? Oh, we're given instructions. I was fulfilling orders, you know.
When you discover how centralized it is
exactly.
The first time, you just can't believe it. I mean, you just can't believe it's so centralized. But sometimes
exactly.
I have to tell you my stories of the burst in 1989, because I was it's a long story. I have a story about sitting in the cash room with Greenspan and Brady and the whole yard, and realizing they were engineering it to crash as low as possible, and then you know, the guys who were selling 6 months before were going to buy at 10%.
Wow.
It was Yeah, my favorite one was, I'll just take a break and tell you, I happened to be confirmed the day that the RTC, the Resolution Trust Corporation legislation passed. And Bob Galber was over at Treasury working on the legislation, and I had a big party to celebrate the swearing, and I had lots of friends and family coming into town. So I invited Bob, and he said, well, you know, I've been working with some guys at Treasury. Would you be willing, you know, could I bring them along? Because we're all exhausted, and we'd love to celebrate this with all that. I said, sure, bring all your friends. So he comes over, he says, this one guy really want to take good care of him. Could you take good care of him? I said, sure, I'll sit next to him at my table at dinner. So he sits down, and I said, oh, you've been working with Bob on the RTC legislation? He said, yeah, I've been here for quite a while. And I said, what do you do? And he said, I work for Warburg in Hamburg. I said, really?
Wow.
Wow, exactly. It was one of those, yeah. So
amazing.
Let's go back to central control, because we only have a tiny bit of time left.
Yes.
And I'm glad you told that story, because it is so, the banking system is so centralized, and how it operates is so invisible, but it does an amazing job of playing these centralized, you know, including the pumps and dumps. You gave a wonderful presentation in Malmo, Sweden, a couple of weeks ago about the absolute possibility of abundance and an abundant economy. And one of the reasons I believe we don't have an abundant economy or anywhere near as abundant as it is because we have so many different industries and cartels trying to centralize. So
yes.
In the last few minutes we have 2 minutes and 22 seconds. What do you feel, with all your experience, are the things that are most draining, you know, us and our economy? What are the forces of centralization which are the most painful economically?
Well, economically, I mean, I think it is, as you say, it is the fact that there are so many, and it's happening on so many levels, and actually even beyond the economy. I mean, there's the media. We've seen it in the last 2.5 years in health, so-called health. And, you know, everything seems to be getting centralized, and that is the trouble. And, of course, that interlocks, and those cartels and big oligopolies, they have so many advantages then as this happens. And it's, you know, as it gets fewer and fewer people have more and more power. But it really doesn't have to be that way. Particularly in central banking and monetary policy, I think we have this issue that some people think, well, of course we need the central bank because we need somebody to set interest rates, don't we? Really?
We need somebody to control us.
Because my empirical work, I mean, if you Google reconsidering monetary policy, that's one paper, and there's another paper that's just come out last week looking at 19 countries. Essentially, with these two papers, I've empirically demonstrated that central banks don't do what everyone thinks, set interest rates, because they just follow the market. So
Right. Actually,
markets set interest rates, and central banks follow with their intervention these market trends. Sometimes, of course, you know, there's moments where they really massively manipulate, for example, especially on the yield curve, the long and short.
Right.
And they've been pushing down artificially the long end with their huge bond purchase operation, things like that. But these are market manipulations. Fundamentally, market set interest, we don't need this intervention. It can also work. Others think we need it for the banks to survive, and that's not true either. When you don't have a central bank, the banks also
right.
do very, very well.
Well, you know, there's no reason we necessarily need a parasitic function to survive. So let me just ask you last question. We have 10 seconds. If we had an excellence in governance, you know, in 190 nations, and we had a functioning market infrastructure, is there any reason you would know of why we couldn't end poverty and have an abundant society on this planet?
Exactly. There's no reason. And my research has also shown me that we can have high, sustainable, equitable, non-inflationary growth that is environmentally sustainable and does not have any crises, no inflation, all these bad stuff, they don't need to happen.
Right.
If you particularly have a banking system that's more amenable to this stability, near full employment, all these things, and actually more markets doing this.
Right.
We're not talking about some centralized control doing this. No, it's actually allowing the markets to do it. This right. is possible. The interventions create these problems.
Right. Okay, well, Richard Werner, thank you for thank everything you. You do. How can we follow your work? Is there one, two, three places we can go to follow your work?
Well, follow me on Twitter. Scientific Econ is one handle. The other one is Professor Werner. Some of my articles, or many of my articles, you'll find on professorwerner.org.
Okay.
And get my book, Princes of the Yen, at quantumpublishers.com.
Uh-huh.
They will try to sell it to you very expensively at Amazon, but get it directly from the publisher, quantumpublishers.com. The search functions won't show this for some reason. I wonder why. But that's where you get the book. And Twitter has usually lots of links to what I'm doing.
Great. Okay. Professor Werner, have a great evening. Thank you for joining us so late from Asia. We really appreciate it. Have a wonderful evening.
Thanks so much. Thanks for having me. Have a good evening.
Okay. Ladies and gentlemen, Dr. Meryl Nass is back, and it's because a group of us saw a presentation she gave not that long ago about solutions. It was so inspiring. It was like a buffet of opportunities for, there was something for everybody. This is a woman who every time she faces evil, which has been a lot over the last many, many years, says, well, what can I do? And you can tell she's thought a lot about what she can do. She's thought a lot about what other people can do. And so we've asked her to come back and give her new updated solutions 2.0. So Dr. Meryl Nass, here you go. You're muted. Unmute.
The first slide, the Great Reset, what they've done and how we can help stop it. Next slide. An oligarchic cabal is trying to take over the world and profit. But let's look carefully at who they are, who they control, what they've done. They have taken over nodes of power. They've spun a web around the world, but their web is full of holes. So yeah, they've taken control of many people in government, media, education, experts, central banks, financial organizations, and they have managed to push out an amazing single narrative, incredible propaganda and mind control. But they don't have 8 billion people. They don't have the police and armies behind them. They have a bunch of nodes. Many of us are paralyzed. We can't believe the extent to which they have taken over control of things. And I think the important thing, which I said earlier, is facing it, okay? It's bad. It's very bad. A small number of oligarchs have managed to figure out what the power points are and to take control of them. And they want to do many terrible things, face it. You know, don't let it fester in your unconscious. Look at it and say, okay, we're going to defeat them because they're a very small number of people. As Catherine has said, they're going to fight with each other. And they don't really know what they're doing. This is a whole craziness that has developed through lots and lots of deceit. Anyway, next slide. We have used primarily two strategies, and they're not enough to fight against this. As we've come to try to understand what's going on, one is just changing people's minds, and I think that's going to be a whole lot easier starting now, and legal cases. And that, too, we think, if Mary Holland is correct, and judges follow culture, should also get easier. But we have to improve our game. I suggest that we have to understand the cabal better, encourage whistleblowers, communicate strategies to reduce fear, and help people understand propaganda and identify it. We've got to destroy the WHO, and they have a bad reputation. Once you dig, you don't have to dig very deep to find it. Identifying the criminals, the apparatchiks and the leaders as much as we can, and make it very uncomfortable to be one of these identified people. And in my own work, I try to identify the scientists who have been lying to us and point out what they've done in the past. I think what's one really important thing is providing people linkages, because now that the price of gasoline and groceries is so high, everybody is realizing something is going on. And so why would, you know, as Dr. Perron said, monkeypox makes no sense at all. This is a biological agent that was released because somebody got the idea that COVID was fading and they needed to scare us with something else. Well, it was a big, you know, bust. And people can figure that out if we help them. We also have to build parallel positive institutions, of course, and we can relish this. You know, we've had institutions that don't work for us. None of our institutions work very well for humans. So let's start creating new ones, and people are already doing that. We don't have to comply, of course. I'm going to talk more about the trickery and the lies, which is what brought us here in the first place. Not carrying a cell phone, paying with cash, refusing vaccines, turning off the media, these are very strong initial steps. So here's what I think happened. The Club of Rome was formed 54 years ago, and 50 years ago they published a book called Limits to Growth. Actually, oddly enough, dated one of the authors when I was in college for a very short time. This was created to spin a false tale. So somebody built a model and said, the planet can't sustain the number of people that are going to be on it, and we're going to have to lower the population and lower consumption if we want to survive. Now that, as you've seen with the models that came out of Bill Gates' Institute for Modeling at the University of Washington, and as you've seen from the models of, University of London, models are garbage in, garbage out. You know, models are only worth something if they actually predict things correctly, and in this case, these models have not. So we used to be frightened of global warming. Remember, it's been over 50 years that the oligarchs have tried to frighten us about global warming. And it was called global warming for a long time. And then the very small increases in warming dropped. So in the last 20 years, there's been less global warming. So they changed it to climate change. Now we're supposed to be worried. And they've succeeded. I can't tell you how many young people I know that have tried to dedicate months or years of their life to fighting climate change. And they don't know what they're doing. We started keeping track of the planet's climate to some extent starting in 1850, and we've gone up 1 degree centigrade since then overall, if you add the land and the oceans together. 1 degree centigrade, and this is what people are, you know, yelling and screaming about. Also, it's my impression, having been in Cuba right after Hurricane Andrew, where the Cubans thought this was weather warfare done by the United States. And we've known that for decades, the United States has had the ability to wage different kinds of weather warfare. I think the global floods and fires, especially some of them that occurred in very strange patterns, were probably due to weapons. And it is very likely that they were created to convince us that this amorphous concept of climate change is harming us, and that we have to therefore live differently and give up things. Identity politics is another concept that has really permeated the culture, but it has done it in a way that has replaced positive values with superficial values like skin color or sexual preference. And this is not good for our children or ourselves. We have to change the values of our culture. Critical race theory has taught people to dislike themselves. This is a bizarre teaching strategy. that has had huge ramifications throughout. I couldn't believe it. But it goes beyond these things. I recently learned that the teaching of reading has been designed so kids don't learn to read, called whole language. You read to kids, and they're supposed to figure out how to read all by themselves. You don't teach them phonics anymore. So all of this has been done basically to weaken the structure of our society. This is just a page off of the Club of Rome website, because these idiots are still active. They blame three things, you know, climate change, loss of biodiversity, and pandemics. These things are due to human actions, and we have to curtail them. The World Economic Forum, of course, is blaming pandemics. But they're not the only ones who blame pandemics on climate change. It seems they control the levers of power, but basically they have a bunch of flunkies who do their bidding. And my sense, my impression, is that the flunkies have been induced to become flunkies because they believe the climate change story and the rest of these false narratives. And they think it's okay, you know, they have to do these terrible things to us to save the planet. Well, we just have to help convince people the planet doesn't need saving. It wasn't at risk in the first place. You know, it's a job, but we have to start making fun of them. Supposedly, there is less sunspot activity, and the planet is going to get cooler for the next few years. So that will help us. Got to explode the myths. So, next slide. Tony Fauci had the nerve to publish an article which claimed that, I'll read it, in a human-dominated world in which our human activities represent aggressive, damaging, and unbalanced interactions with nature, we humans, will increasingly provoke new disease emergencies. So you wonder why Tony, it was so important to Tony to make sure to cover up the lab origin of COVID, because he was positioning, right, human activities, too much human activity, to be at the root of this natural COVID. He couldn't let it come from a lab. This slide, destruction of wildlife and the climate crisis is hurting humanity, with COVID-19 a clear warning shot. This is from the UN's environmental chief. And then from the same article in The Guardian, to prevent further outbreaks, the experts said, both global heating and the destruction of the natural world for farming, mining, and housing have to end, as both drive wildlife into contact with people. So you can see they want to herd us into smart cities. They want to leave the natural world for themselves. And, you know, where's the evidence that any of this makes any sense at all? All right, so the governments and the oligarchy bought the media, but really they rented the media. I mean, if everybody stops watching and stops consuming it, the media will have to figure out another way to get us back or collapse. In the future, they may find ways, they may decide to restrict our internet presence completely, but on the other hand, they will lose the ability to track us if they do that. In any event, I think we should be ready. I think developing phone number networks, places to put up posters and handbills where people can communicate with each other without any electronic means, including phones, will be valuable. There are many things you can do to prepare to just make yourself feel more comfortable, as I do with my garden and my guns. This is an invention a friend of mine made. He is a successful inventor, and he can sell this little tiny solar-powered tractor as parts for $2,000. So there are ways we can grow more easily and use technology to our advantage. Next slide, they've downgraded all our institutions, which just means it's our responsibility and our enjoyment and pleasure to create better institutions, better schools, better healthcare, better laws, at least a system of law in which the government agencies and government officials can in fact be charged, just like the rest of us. And of course, free speech. I mentioned linking things before. I think it's very important because that really helps people understand the whole story. Yeah, monkeypox is part of it, and the Ukraine war is part of it, and they embargoed the oil to raise the price because they want to make people poorer, you know, blah, blah, blah. I think this is a story people can start to understand now that they're really being squeezed. We have to stay connected with each other. This is only a very partial list of organizations that have put out useful information for all of us fighting the reset. Next slide. Don't trigger defensiveness, which is something I do all the time. Use humor. People let their guard down when things are humorous, ask questions. What that means is instead of saying to someone, why did you get that stupid vaccine? It doesn't even work. You ask them, how long will your vaccine work? And then they have to think about that. How long will it work? You know, why do they have to get another booster at 4 months? And do they want to keep getting boosters for an illness that has now become a cold, generally? All right, next four slides. Let's just go through them very fast. They're all jokes that hopefully will help spread the message. Next slide is number 23, publicly identifying the criminals. And I think something along the model of a Truth and Reconciliation Commission is really important because it's probably the only way to encourage the apparatchiks who are working against us to come over to our side and become whistleblowers by telling them, look, you tell your story, you answer all our questions, you have a hearing in basically a courtroom, a special court for the Truth Commission. And if you tell us everything, you get off. So it worked in South Africa. South Africa in 1993, everyone expected a race war and they did not have one, which was extraordinary. Next slide. Medicine has basically shot itself in the head, and this is another opportunity. Everybody hates the system. Everybody hates pharma. And a lot of people have good ideas about how to fix it. Next slide. How can we do better? We have to coordinate better. We just have to figure out how to do that. Right now, all these organizations are doing great things, but we're not figuring out how to maximize our efforts. The CBDGs, the electronic money, is going to cost a lot of people a lot of money. People who are not paying taxes on all their income and people who are purchasing illicit things will not be able to do so. And that's a big chunk of the population. So we got to spread the word. You know, once you get into the electronic money and give up cash, you know, we're screwed. We mustn't do that, and people need to understand what they're getting into when they do. Okay, next slide. This is basically a repeat of what I said before. They've created a lot of false narratives that have become part of our culture now. But they don't make sense. There's no evidence for them. And we can blow them up. We make fun of them. We take them apart. And finally, let's all work together and enjoy this. We can make a much better society. Thanks very much.
Yay. Thank you, Meryl. I like that as much as the first time that I thought. It's getting better. Anyway, we now turn to a panel, our final panel, before we close this wonderful symposium. The topic is faith in the failure of totalitarianism, and we're joined We're rejoined by Mary Holland and Dr. Peter Bregan, and of course Meryl is going to stay with us. And so let the panel discussion begin. I have a question for all of you. What was it that first inspired you to think, you know, freedom is going to win. Freedom can win. You know, if we look throughout the ages, totalitarianism has done a lot of damage, but ultimately it fails. So I know each of you have thought long and hard about how can freedom win? What can you do to help freedom win? But let me ask you to share some of your most important personal insights on when you were confident that freedom really can win. So Mary, why don't I start with you if I can?
Sure. I honestly believe that most humans want to stay human. I don't think that transhumanism has really popular appeal for people. I think most people who are not with us are deceived, and the other ones are mostly just following orders. I think that really covers most people, not the cabal. I lived in the Soviet Union and then in Russia after the wall came down and the end of the Soviet Union. I lived there for several years. And people want to be free. And, you know, communism was a terrible system. Nazi Germany was a terrible system, but they didn't last forever. This cabal has stronger technological tools, which I'm, you know, deeply concerned about. But people don't want to live in tyranny. They don't. And one thing I want to point out, there's a little book that was published several years ago, 20 Lessons from the 20th Century on Tyranny. And it's 20 things that we can learn from the most tyrannical systems of the 20th century, the communist system and the Nazi system. And they're really important. And the first principle is don't obey in advance. And when you really think about what's happened for the last 2 years with all of these emergency use authorization products, the shots, the masks, the tests, they've all on some level been voluntary. This was by design, right? This was sort of preemptive, voluntary, quote unquote. I'm not saying people weren't coerced. People were definitely coerced. But it wasn't, they didn't put a gun to our head. They didn't put a gun to our head. This was obeying in advance. And I just think that that's really important. I believe we will win. But I do think, you know, like Meryl says, we have to work better together. We have to get the word out. And we have to build and have fun with building the parallel world.
Right. Peter, what about you? Peter, can you hear me? You're on mute.
I'm doing it again. Am I back now?
Yes, you're back.
Yeah, it seems to come and go. Hi, everybody, again.
Hi. Did you hear my question?
Yeah. I wanted to tell people how much I'm enjoying you too, very much. And I appreciate getting to know you. And Mary, I didn't know you very well, but you're amazing. And Meryl, I love you. You were one of the first people who supported what we were doing and taught me. I'm glad to see you looking so good. So I have a slightly different take. I think people, in a way, love totalitarianism. If you look at the history of the world, it's a very sad thing. And that is, we had maybe a million years of being hunter-gatherers and developing from our living in trees to living together. And we had our extended families for hundreds of thousands of years. And as Homo sapiens, we continued to have our families. But around 10,000, 11,000 years ago, people thought there'd be an advantage to sitting still and sedentary and raising flocks and wheat and living in structures that they could really build before they couldn't, because they couldn't carry them around. But from that moment on, within 100 years, we have villages and towns with walls around them to protect them from other villages. And then within 500, it's really unclear. I mean, there's such overlaps in the various historians. We got empires. Certainly by 3000 BC, we have empires, or 4000 BC. And it strikes me that human beings are unprepared to live in large groups under authority, and they become obedient like children. They regress to childhood. And this has been our history forever. I thought that people always wanted freedom, and I expressed that as one thing I really learned from an instructor at Harvard. And I said to him, I think people really do yearn for freedom. He said, they must have been rebelling against the feudal system all the time. He said, look, you know a little Latin. They're in English, too. Go read the Homeroot records from a medieval Great Britain. And so I went into Widener. In those days, you could go right on down and get something and read it. And what I found was that the people in the villages were the most mean police of all on each other. Oh, my God, reporting somebody for putting his garden slightly over into the edge of the forest that belonged to the manor. God forbid you got caught hunting. So I had to revise my thinking very early about not everybody was like me, and maybe it was not in the same time as now where we have freedom and so we can see it. But I take a different lesson from it all. I mean, when you see Nazi Germany and communist China, I say totalitarianism triumphs all the time. It just changes forms, gets taken down, and new totalitarianisms come. Then there was the miracle. And I think the miracle starts with the story of the Jews leaving. God wants the Jews to have freedom. That was a very big story for the founders. Then it goes on to Jesus, who says that we are all made in God's image, which sort of makes living under totalitarianism a little funny. We're treasures. And then the founders of America put it all together in some miraculous fashion, even though half of them at least were slaveholders, they put it together that we should be born free, nature and God, and nature's God say we should be born free. I think it was a miracle, and our job is to keep the miracle alive and to be honored that we live in an age of a miracle where we too might be founders. So that's why I talk about refounding America. So I think freedom is not the natural state once we started living under roofs in groups. We just become so docile and we saw it again. But if you can have a nation with a religious spirit and a God spirit and a patriotic spirit and all the other stuff that goes into, I'm free, I'm going to stand up for myself, take responsibility for myself, that's the miracle, and maybe someday it'll be the norm, and it is the answer. And that's one of the things. The answer to all the problems we look at, the closest we can come is to have more constitutional republics throughout the world. They don't fight with each other. They don't kill their own citizens. They don't have famines even in constitutional republics. We have more freedom in them. Well, we're starting to lose it, of course. I understand that dreadfully now under Biden and so on. Under Bush, we've been losing it for a long time. So I'd say it's a miracle, freedom, and let's fight for it, and let's just thank God we're here and have this opportunity. But I don't think that the totalitarian regimes, I don't have faith in their ending. I have faith in God. Oh, geez, I never thought I'd say that. I have faith in God. I have faith in that he wants us to be free. And I have faith that we can, if we work hard enough, we may be blessed to have a new rebirth of freedom. So it's a little different take, but we come out the same place. Let's fight for our freedom. Let's fight for constitutional democracy.
Well, the founding documents say that our freedom comes to us by divine authority.
Absolutely.
That is the authority.
That's absolutely.
Okay, so Meryl, so let's turn to you. What has inspired you to believe that freedom is going to win?
You've helped.
That's beautiful.
Because you said they're all going to fight each other. they're not going to maintain any kind of uniform, wall against us. And the more I started thinking about it, it's such a dystopian future that these idiots are trying to push for. They don't even know what they're doing, and almost nobody is going to follow them. It's just a question of time, before everybody peels off. And it's a question of, how much misery is there going to be before then?
Right. So, Mary, Children's Health Defense has really been in the lead in bringing litigation, but also helping to organize people and to give them a voice. Tell us a little bit about the people who work with Children's Health Defense, who read The Defender. What is the impulse that has gathered them and is driving them?
Well, I like to think that Children's Health Defense is one of these new institutions of the parallel universe, that we're creating truthful news and we're creating truthful TV, which we're on right now. And we're bringing cases that defend fundamental human rights and defend free expression and thought. And, you know, the good news is I think it's a growing community, Catherine. I do think it's a growing community. I think we started as, in many ways, families with children who had been injured by toxic exposures, particularly vaccines. But I think particularly in COVID, the universe of people trying to figure out what the hell's going on, and I don't like it, has expanded greatly. So I think we are, you know, learning as we go. And I agree with Meryl. I think a failing of our community is less synergies, less cooperation that is helpful. But I also really think, you know, it's going to be 1,000 different efforts that are going to take us over the top and are going to sort of overcome this totalitarianism. And I understand Peter's point, and I agree that totalitarianism works. You helped me understand, Catherine, you know, slavery is very profitable. There right. will always be people who want slavery. It is very right. profitable.
Right.
But I truly don't believe that, I really, maybe this is my faith, but I believe that people do want to be free. I really do believe that people do want to be free.
Okay, well, one of the things I have to bring up is the best idea of the year, or it could have been the best idea yet last year, I don't remember. But I was sitting in a wonderful home with Mary, and I think, Meryl, you were there, and we were talking about the importance of getting everybody to use cash and not allowing the systems to go to all digital where we can be controlled. And we're talking about, and you said, well, why don't we do Cash Friday? And everybody just stopped, and I said, that's a brilliant idea. So we did. On the way home from that trip, two of us stopped, and we got our first receipt. It says Cash Friday number one. That was my first Cash Friday receipt.
Mm-hmm.
And now we've changed it. Polly Tommy has changed the name to Cash Every Day. She said, we've graduated. We're going to Cash Every Day.
I agree.
And the thing that's been wonderful about it is not just everybody using cash, but the conversations that are happening. People are talking to each other. They're hugging each other. They're doing deals together. It's kind of like a whole new, it's this parallel institutions are opening up as people start to realize, you know, I can bushwhack my way to a new economy just by starting not only to use cash, but have a conversation. One person wrote into us and said, you know, I talked to my dry cleaner. They're losing $2,500 a month to credit card fees. And their hangers have increased tremendously. So we all got together and we're bringing our hangers back to recycle them. And now we're all paying cash. And, you know, they can start to make a decent living.
Wow.
Yeah, it's just a little thing. But when you multiply that throughout millions of people, it's a revolution. And what's brilliant about Cash Friday is, you know, you don't have to get in a fight with the Department of Justice when you use, at least now.
Right. Catherine, the first time I heard about that was when I interviewed you for our show, our radio
uh-huh.
show. And this is a joint show I do with Ginger, which is different than some other shows. And when I got off, Ginger was saying, boy, Cash Friday, you know, he's been struggling. Well, I don't know, you know, that's not going to work or whatever. I'm mumbling away there.
Uh-huh.
And she just went after me and said, no, that is gonna work.
Right.
You don't get it. So she's got me now, and I get it, and I think it's a fabulous idea. And
well, if you look at the Fed statistics, cash is skyrocketing. Okay, so Meryl, you are, you know, you're operating in the United States, but you're doing a lot of travel, you're going to a lot of places. What has enabled you to keep your state of amusement? Because you do a very good job of keeping your state of amusement, even though you've been under tremendous pressure, you know, squabbling as a doctor trying to protect, you know, yourself from the regulators. We all have had those battles. How have you managed to keep your sense of humor? Because that is so important to, you know, this is a long distance journey, and you have to keep your sense of amusement going. So tell us, Meryl, how you have done it.
Well, I hate to admit it, but when in my younger years, I did a lot of meditation. And I know everybody doesn't have that, but now, you know, it's something I said in Malmo, which is that I feel grateful to be in this time and to be able to work on something that's so important. And, I get pleasure from looking at the different propaganda techniques and the other nonsense that, you know, I get frustrated, I get angry, of course, but in a way I'm amused, except when it comes to vaccinating little kids with these poisons, and I have no amusement there. But for most of the rest, I say, we just need some real good comedians to blow this up, you know, because it's all bullshit, you know, all the politically correct speech. People don't like it. They've just been, you know, acculturated. Sorry about that. They've been acculturated to it. And they're going to love it when we blow that up. Right. So they're going to love it when we blow up critical race theory. So I think, yeah, it's just a question. Let's have fun with that, and let's show how these bastards have ruined our culture and how we are taking it back.
So, Peter, what are their weak spots? So totalitarianism is, you know, can be very powerful, very dangerous. What are their weak spots? What are the weak spots we need to take advantage of?
Well, I think they tremendously underestimate the freedom and freedom fighters. They just don't get the human spirit at all. Their whole approach is that other people are not really quite human. And I think that gives us a big advantage. And we've been able to really begin developing a new freedom fight. I don't think they have any idea even how much of a freedom movement there is in the world and in the United States. I think we can just keep on building this. And the other thing is, as you point out, they're so over-leveraged. They're just so overextended, be a word maybe other people could understand better outside of the finance. They're so overextended that just like the Soviet Union, eventually just some freedom fighters can topple them. So what I'd like to just say a word about is keeping with what everyone else is saying. These are wonderful times. If you join us, you might get to meet Meryl Nass at a conference, or Mary Holland, or Catherine Fitz, and have the time of your life. You won't get me, because I don't travel. I'm 86. I stay at home. But you can see me on TV. You will find the most wonderful people you've ever met. I've been doing reform work, oh, God, since I was a kid. So was Ginger. Ginger reformed her hometown when she was a teenager. We've been doing this forever. We have never been in such an incredible group of people. And one of them, Meryl, I mean, just stepped up right away very early on. I didn't know anything about vaccines and all that. You just taught away and just gave that up to me and to Ginger. And then I, you know, didn't know anything about finance in the way you are talking about, Catherine, and you joined in. Folks, this is what will happen to you if you just start bringing together some of your neighbors, because the neighbors who come are going to be the best in the community, and they're going to like freedom, and they want to take responsibility for themselves. They may love America. You may just find yourself for the first time free of all the inhibitions of being with people who belong to our failure world, because this is a world you can see. This is, we're not exceptions. There are hundreds of thousands of us, if not millions of us, around the world. So join the movement, and that will do so much for your spirit. If you have any belief in God, you'll just thank God. Meryl talked about gratitude. I express gratitude many times every day. So does Ginger. And you will be so grateful for the people you get to work with. And I think that in itself, a sustaining belief that we're doing what we're supposed to do, George Washington called it providence or God, and that we have these wonderful, wonderful people to work with. Folks, it's incredible. And it's going to be true, not just on a higher leadership levels. I mean, we have assistants who are just so happy to be able to work for somebody who actually believes them. And that's here in Ithaca, which is like, you know, it's like, you know, a horrible big college town. And yet we have people here who are just so happy to be a part of this movement. So
Mary, one question for you. We saw an effort in the United States to create this disinformation operation at the Department of Homeland Security. The first effort failed, but there are rumors about coming back with somebody even more totalitarian. So there's clearly going to be a push to control information. Meryl mentioned it. What do you think we can do to protect our right to share excellent scientific and medical information?
Well, I was encouraged, Catherine, by the spectacular failure of the first effort to create a disinformation board. I mean, it absolutely sputtered and failed within days. And the woman that they had found was a laughingstock, as Meryl said, just a laughingstock of her TikTok video. So that was really encouraging. There's some really good lawsuits right now about the big tech government collusion, including one we have where we're waiting for a decision from the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. I really do believe that if that gets blown up, that the government is working with big tech, as it clearly is, and we can undo that, there will be more opportunities for free speech and for free press. But even now, Catherine, I'm also very encouraged by, you know, BitChute and Rumble and Sovereign and these other, and our own CHD's platform. There are uncensored spots where we can give and share real information, including science.
Right. Okay, we only have a few more. We have one more minute. I want you to go around and tell how people can find you. I know for Meryl and Peter, I've asked you before, and how we can support you. Because a lot of people say to me, you know, I don't want to get out front. And I said, no problem. Find your favorite person who is out front and support them. So how can we support you, and how can we learn more about what you're doing? I'll start with you, Mary.
So childrenshealthdefense.org. I have a weekly podcast with Polly Tommy where we cover sort of, we think, the news that people should know. It's mainstream news. And you can write to CHD at childrenshealthdefense.org. Sign up for the Defender. Get on those text messages for TV. We welcome everybody.
Right. I'm a member. Everybody I know is a member. We love you. Okay, Meryl Nass.
So I have a Substack, MerylNass.substack.com. I have a blog, MerylNassMD.com, and I had my medical license suspended in January for spreading disinformation online and for prescribing hydroxychloroquine and ivermectin. By the way, nothing that I've been accused of is a crime. There's no rule or regulation saying can't do any of it, but I have expensive lawsuit going. I haven't had a hearing yet, and Children's Health Defense is helping to fund my defense. And if you feel pushed, you know, to contribute to Children's Health Defense for my defense, that would be very wonderful. Thank you.
So, you know, I'm an investment banker, so I just have to say this. Once upon a time, I had a client call me during COVID, and she said, you know, I'm selling a big piece of real estate. What should I put the money into? It was a former client. I'm not currently an investment advisor. And I said, what's the point of having assets if you don't have an army? She said, what did I do? I said, go give a big chunk of money to But it's true. If we don't have an army, we won't have assets. So, you know, look around and build your army, and Children's Health Defense is clearly one of our armies, and we're very grateful. Okay, Peter Bregan, how do we follow you? How do we support you?
Support Meryl Nass. I've been through what she went through.
Yes.
And somebody came through for me enormously out of the blue and made me whole again after a huge course. Support Meryl Nass, and I'll be a happy man. Bregan, at hotmail.com is our basic website. And you can follow us.
Regina@hotmail.com is your, must be your email.
That's my email. Oh, yeah. My God. Erase that. It's a long day. Regin.com, BREGGIN.com is my website.
Uh-huh.
And we, Ginger runs a Bregan Alerts that she is very active in. She's an amazing writer and amazing researcher. Uh-huh. And that'll keep you up with everything we're doing. I think that's the basic thing to do to get our book. We feel our book's the most important thing we've done practically in our lives. COVID-19 and the global predators. Oh, God, Mary's holding it up. That's so beautiful.
Oh,
and Bobby Kennedy gave me a wonderful endorsement, said we're the deepest dive into the background and the knowledge.
I have a whole Peter Bregan pile on my bookshelf. It's the Peter Bregan section.
It was just, it was here.
Okay, well, ladies and gentlemen, thank you so much for joining us on the Doctors for COVID Ethics 4 Symposium. We're just very, very grateful and appreciative. This has been a great panel and a great symposium. Thank you so much. Okay, so let's, as our last session, I'm going to do two things. I'm going to close with my favorite story from the Bible, the story of Gideon, and it's the story of how the bad guys kill each other. It's, I call it the Midianite thing. Meryl's heard me talk about it very many times. Before I do that, though, I just want to thank